Hello and you're listening to Pulse Radio, LSESU's official radio station. My name's Michael Pearson.
And my name is Christina Maisko.
And you're listening to The Interview Hour.
Each Friday between 5 to 6 on The Interview Hour, we'll be talking to distinguished figures from the fields of politics, current affairs, arts and academia.
We'll try and find out how they became interested in their field, discuss their career as a whole and talk about the relevant issues of the day.
You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/The Interview Hour or on our website at www.pulselsc.co.uk.
If you want to join the debate on Twitter, it's at Interview Hour, or if you want to email the show, it's onair@pulselsc.co.uk.
Now, we're joined in the studio today by an all-round political guru. He stood as Conservative candidate in 2005 and came to prominence as a respected political commentator for his political blog, Ian Dale's Diary, and now hosts the Ian Dale & Co. blog online.
He's a publisher of Total Politics magazine, LBC 97.3 talk show host, editor and author of a wide range of books, everything from political blogging to West Ham United, and all around nice guy, Ian Dale. Welcome to Pulse Radio.
Hi.
Thank you very much for coming on to our show.
Not at all.
So, before we even start, do you have any interviewing tips for us?
Well, I think there are different styles of interviews. I take the view that if you're doing an interview with someone, they're spending time with you, you should respect the fact that they've come into your studio rather than shout at them, because I just can't stand interviewers who think that their role is to provide some sort of bullfighting spectacle. I mean, what you're there to do as an interviewer is to get information out of somebody, make it entertaining for the listener. But there are so many people on British radio nowadays who think that they are the star of the show. Mm. Actually, your guests should be the star of the show. And if it's all about you as the interviewer, I think you've failed. So if you two want to shut up for the next 57 minutes, I'll just continue.
Yeah. Well, rest assured, we're not going to shout at you. And
in terms of your interviewee, have you had any bad experiences on that part, or advice for yourself in this circumstance?
Actually, last Sunday on my Sunday morning show on LBC, we were talking about whether MPs should travel first class by train. And we got somebody on who I didn't know, who had written a book on MPs' expenses. And I think if you've written a book, you've presumably researched it, you know your facts. So we started off the interview, and it became quite clear early on that this guy had a political agenda of his own, that he hadn't really researched the subject. So I began to get a little bit tetchy as the interview went on, which is unlike me. And my producer, as it went on, screamed in my ear, "You're getting chippy, stop it." And then, and of course, that made me do it even more. Mm. And he then made the assertion that most Tory MPs had outside incomes of £100,000, £150,000, £200,000. Now, if he had done his research, he would know that wasn't correct. Sure, they were the odd one. Mm. So I said to him, "Well, how many are there?" He said, "Oh, a third of them." I said, "You're talking rubbish. How can you possibly say that? You clearly haven't researched it." And at that point, my producer exploded and said, "This is really bad radio." Now, I listened back to it afterwards, and actually, I thought it was great radio, but there you go.
And how much advice do you actually take on board from your listeners or your producer?
Well, I'm not a trained broadcaster. I came to radio fairly late in life. I'd done a lot of punditry, but I'd never done any real presenting. I did, I doubt whether you remember it, there was a programme called Sunday Service on 5 Live, probably that ran between, I don't know, 1997 and 2002, and it had Fee Glover, who I think is probably one of the greatest presenters on radio at the moment. She was the main host, and then she had somebody from the left, somebody from the right, Charlie Whelan from the left, Andrew Pearce from the right. When Andrew Pearce was on holiday, I used to deputise, so that was really the only time that I'd done any sort of presenting, but it was still with other people. We can go into how I got the LBC job if you like, but I started that doing that two years ago, and you do learn on the job. I mean, you're thrown in at the deep end. I remember my first show was covering for Petri Hoskin in the evening. They rang me up that lunchtime and said, "Do you want to come and do the show this evening?" Well, I had no training for it. I didn't know how to use the phone box switchboard where you've got all the people phoning in. I didn't know that you had to wait till the person was in the green or the blue box at the bottom before you could speak to them. Yeah. So I say, "Oh, let's go to Dave in Walthamstow." And strangely, Dave wasn't there. And they didn't tell me that when you go to the travel, you say, "It's 7:15, wait for the sting. Let's go across to Alan Cowie in the LBC 97.3 Travel Centre." So I kept crashing it the whole time because there just was no time to teach me all that. But once I got the hang of it, it was fine. But I reckon it took me 9 months before I thought, yep, I can do this. But even now, 2 years on, I still feel that there are things that I can improve on. I don't think I'm the finished article, which in 50 years of age you ought to be, I suppose.
How do you prepare for interviews? Because you do quite a few interviews with respective figures. What's the process that goes on there?
The simple answer is I don't.
Okay.
Because I find, and everyone has a different approach, I say I don't, that's... Generally, if I'm doing my evening show, we don't know what we're going to do from one day to the next because it's a news-driven programme. So I don't know who I'm going to be interviewing when I go into the studio. So I get there at about 4, 4.30, decide with the producer what we're going to do in each hour, then decide on the guests. So if it's a subject that I'm reasonably familiar with, you just sort of wing it. You might have to read up a little bit about the story if it's not something you're familiar with. But, other interviews, if it's a big set-piece interview, I suppose I will. I'm interviewing Conrad Black on Sunday at 10 o'clock. Now, having seen his experience with Jeremy Paxman and Adam Bolton this week, I'm on a bit of a hiding to nothing on that interview. So I honestly don't know how best to prepare for it. So
it's quite
tune in and find
out. So it's quite an organic process as opposed to I assume a lot of TV interviews where they have a team of people, researchers.
I mean, we're not the BBC. We don't have a team of 10 people working on the programme. I have a single producer. We have an assistant producer who answers the phones, but they only come in half an hour before the programme. So I haven't got a team of people doing all that. I have no script. I do an opening monologue. I don't write it. I just do it. And I mean, sometimes it'll be better than others. And I mean, you as a presenter know when you've done a good one or when you haven't. I do I started interviewing quite a lot of celebrities outside politics. We do a book hour. I did an hour with Joan Rivers the other night. Well, how can you prepare for an interview with Joan Rivers? I mean, you know what she's like. And I mean, I must admit, I was quite nervous before that one because it had a tremendous opportunity to go wrong. I did Miranda Hart last week. And
I mean,
the thing that I hate about people who interview celebrities is when they just say, oh, I love all your work. It's the most wonderful thing. I don't know how you do it so well. When you know full well that there are bits that they don't like or they might not even like it at all. So I don't do that. So with Miranda Hart, we talked about her sitcom, which I think is fantastic. But I hate Call the Midwife. Just hate all of these medical programmes on a Sunday night. Why do we have to have all these hospital programmes at weekends? So I told her I hated it, which I think she was quite surprised by. And it then dominated the rest of the interview as a sort of running theme. But the good thing was it gave her the chance to be quite funny about it. So when I asked her at the end, so what are you doing next? She said, I'm recording a series of that programme that you hate. And it kind of worked. You can listen to the podcast free online at lbc.co.
That's a nice little plug.
Good advertisement. And also, how do you react to your interview? Usually, do you change your attitude a little bit from interview to interview, or is it a consistent approach?
There are people that you interview that you think you're going to hate, or you think you're going to really like. Comedians, often, when you interview them, they're not as funny in real life as they are from the image that they put forward on television. Miranda Hart was quite funny, but slightly different to the character that I was expecting. But it's great to meet people that sometimes you've grown up with. I met, I don't know if you're familiar with the horror writer James Herbert, who wrote The Rats and things like that. I remember reading that book at the age of about 14. It actually provided most of my sex education. and he came into the studio, and I was really in awe of him because he is a brilliant writer. But he wasn't at all how I imagined. Now, I'm not going to say I didn't like him, but he wasn't quite the character that I thought he was going to be.
That's part of me thinks I don't really want to meet my heroes, just in case they shatter my illusions.
Who are your heroes?
I have to say you.
No, because he would be lying.
Jimmy Carr, Noel Gallagher.
Jimmy Carr?
Yeah.
That shows a notable lack of judgment. I can't stand Jimmy Carr.
Okay.
I actually had the opportunity to interview him and I thought I really don't want to.
Okay.
Because I don't think I could hide my dislike. But there we go. I don't find it funny. That 10 o'clock show on Channel 4, I just think it's awful.
Which stand-up comedians do you like?
Stand-up comedians that I like. Josie Lawrence, I don't know if you've heard of her, she was really famous in the late 1980s. She did with Clive Anderson, Whose Line Is It Anyway? An improvisation show. She was fantastic on that. Because when you ask who do you like, you just found you couldn't think of anyone. And I'm not trying to think. I mean, I love stand-up comedy. I don't particularly like Michael McIntyre. I don't really get him at all.
I liked him at the start.
Milton Jones, I think, is very funny. And I quite like smutty comedians.
And how did you get into radio yourself? What attracted you to it in the first place?
I've always liked radio more than television. I mean, I do bits of television, but on radio you've just got time to go into a subject, and particularly on the kind of show I do, we don't really do two-minute interviews. And the problem, I think, with a lot of news programmes, particularly on sort of 5 Live Radio 4, you get a politician onto the programme and they know that they're going to have to put over their point in 3, 4, probably maximum 5 minutes, sometimes 2 minutes. So their spin doctors say, right, these are the 3 points that you need to make in the interview. It doesn't matter what you're asked, just make the points and make them again. And it's just a very sterile approach to interviewing.
It's very much learn the lines and just get it out.
It absolutely is. So I like the long form interview. I'm not saying I don't do any short ones, I do. But that's why I like on my Sunday show, we have a political guest in for an hour at 10 o'clock. I interview them for maybe 20 minutes and then we take listener calls. But there are very few programmes on the radio now or even on television where you have one interviewer, one interviewee, and they just talk. Now, you can get an awful lot out of people in an hour. You don't get much in the first 10, 15 minutes, maybe, but you do after that. Once they've relaxed, and it becomes... I like to look at it as a conversation rather than an interview, because if somebody feels they're being grilled, they just, as I said before...
The mindset changes.
Yeah, they get defensive, whereas if they view you, rather than as an interviewer, as a sort of political contemporary, somebody interested in politics, you can have a conversation with them. And invariably, I get news lines out of these interviews, which I don't think I would get if I was constantly haranguing them and sort of taking the why are you lying to me approach.
What do you think makes a great talk radio programme then? What are the key ingredients you'd give to any aspiring talk radio show hosts?
I think you've got to be yourself. You've got to be genuine. There are people on radio who create a radio personality for themselves that is not them at all. It might work for some people. I don't think it works generally. I think you've got to insert yourself into the programme. You've got to tell people about yourself a bit. I mean, not sort of gratuitously, but if you're talking about, I don't know, if you're talking about depression and you suffer from depression, why not tell the listeners? You'll get some brilliant calls that way. My mother died earlier this year and I talked about it on the radio. Now, you can go over the top on these things and really annoy people by doing it too much. But I mean, my partner hates it when I do it. Says, can't you keep anything private? And I understand that point of view. But I think if you're trying to create, trying to build an audience, trying to create a relationship between you and the audience, and it's actually between you and the individual listener, it's not these sort of amorphous group of people out there. They're all individuals. Some of them will like you, some of them won't. And, I mean, I guess the success is to make sure more of them like you than not. But I mean, it's not actually all about liking. They've got to respect that you know what you're talking about. They don't want you to be seen as some sort of propagandist. And, I mean, part of my problem at the beginning was I was seen as a bit of a Tory. And I think now anybody who held that view at the beginning, I mean, I haven't changed my views, but I don't go on the radio to sort of propagandise for David Cameron. In fact, far from it. I mean, I think in some ways you go the opposite way. And so you're sort of trying to prove to the audience that you're not any sort of propagandist. So you sort of... In the LBC complaints inbox, you get a lot of people saying, God, that Ian Daly's a bit left-wing, isn't he? Which I think is hilarious.
Yeah.
But people... I suppose because when I was doing my blog, people did see me as a bit of an attack dog, whereas now I love doing, in my sort of 8 o'clock hours, I love doing sort of emotional subjects. I mean, from depression, bereavement. We did one last week on how women cope with losing a baby, either just before it's born or just afterwards. Well, I mean, you can't do subjects like that if you are a sort of hatchet-faced hard man. You've got to be able to empathise with the audience. And I remember the first time that I did one of these subjects, the station director, it was about whether Channel 4 should be allowed to transmit adverts advertising abortion clinics, and they won their appeal to the Advertising Standards Authority. And I got 5 women phone in telling me about their abortions. Now, that was way outside my comfort zone, and I didn't know if I'd handle it properly. So I sort of asked the station director, And he said, well, you will get these people ringing in because you've got a sort of calming voice. You're not threatening. You don't interrupt people. You let the callers talk. So you will get these calls. And that's what I found over the last 2 years. So, I mean, if anything, I think I've become known for those things rather than necessarily the political side.
I remember I grew up listening a lot to Talk Sport, so Ian Collins, James Whale, Mike Dickin, etc. And I guess what came through there and is talk radio can be very easy if you pick sort of very regular talk radio topics like death penalty, stuff that's quite emotive and negative. Do you think it... talk radio nowadays has evolved, or does it still is it still too negative?
If you want to be lazy as a talk show host, you pick any one of these subjects: abortion, homosexuality, climate change, Israel. I can't remember what the other one is, but those are the subjects that can guarantee you a full switchboard. So as a presenter, frankly, you don't really have to think very much. Now, the challenging ones are the subjects that you think, well, we might not get a single call on this. And it depends what your priorities are. If your priorities are to get a full switchboard of calls, then you pick those subjects. Mm. If your priorities are to sort of challenge yourself as a presenter and indeed challenge the audience and accept that in the whole hour you might only get five calls, but they might be five absolutely cracking calls, then, I mean, that's kind of the approach that I use. I mean, Ian Collins, James Well, they're both colleagues of mine on LBC now. And each one of the LBC presenters has a very different approach. I mean, I have learned so much from James Well. He does the show before me. And, I mean, he's been doing talk radio for, I don't know, 40 years. But, I mean, what he doesn't know about talk radio isn't worth knowing. And there are all sorts of other people who you listen to and pick up tips from and try and incorporate it into your own show, but still keep it your own style.
Which has been the most challenging show in terms of the topic that you've chosen? Something that was original or not usually talked about?
Well, two come to mind, both actually fairly recent. There was one about a month ago. We did one on male attitudes to rape. Now, not a fun subject. And I got quite a few women ringing in, but I also got men ringing in who had been raped. Now, that is quite a difficult one to talk about on the radio at 8 o'clock at night. Virtually every caller that rang in that programme got quite emotional about it, as you can imagine. We then had a lady phone in who was about 50, and she had been raped 11 years before by someone that she knew. And I mean, she'd been raped anally. Now, again, how do you explain that on radio? And she found it very difficult. And, of course, as the presenter, your role is to facilitate her or sort of help her try and say what she's trying to say. And she ended up saying, well, it wasn't up the vagina. Now, from a listener, would be an argument for pressing the dump button on something like that. But because it was so sort of integral to what she was trying to say, we didn't. And I did think we might get in trouble for that. But she got quite emotional, and she said she'd never told her husband about it. And I remember at the end of the... I could see the clock going right up to the hour, thinking, oh, my God, how can I stop this call before the news? And very unusually, I went past 9 o'clock, because, I mean, you're not supposed to do that. Mm. But there was no way that I could just cut her off, because, I mean, it would have sounded crass. And I said to her at the beginning, I said, well, you've been really brave calling in to talk about this, and be assured that there will be people out there that you have helped by the fact that you have described it, because you're not the only one. And she then said, I can't tell you how much that means to me. The next night she phoned back and she told her husband, and I was thinking, oh my God, what have we done? But he was brilliant about it, and she wanted to come on air. Of course, we were doing a totally different subject the next night. I let her come on air, and she said, you have no idea what this has meant to me. It's as if I can see the sky again. And even now I'm sort of getting quite emotional talking about it. So I mean, that's when you find out about yourself as a presenter. And I had one last week. Bill on the M25, I should remember that for a long time, because he threatened to commit suicide. Now, there are all sorts of things that go through your mind then. You're not aware of the rest of the audience. It's a conversation between you and one other person, and your entire focus is on that person. There is this little voice in the back of your head, if I'm honest, that says one word wrong here and you get an Ofcom complaint. You can lose your job, or you could provoke him into doing what he's threatening to do. And that, I mean, that's the most important thing, I suppose. This call lasted about 15 minutes. I sort of ditched the travel. And it's become the subject of a BBC College of Journalism blog, because the guy that runs the College of Journalism actually was listening. And he rang me up a few days later and he said that was one of the most powerful pieces of radio I've heard in my entire life, and you should be congratulated for how you handled it. Now, at the time, I wasn't sure that I had handled it right. I said, look, I'm not going to play amateur psychologist. I really want you, when you finish this call, I want you to pick up the phone and dial this number for the Samaritans or whatever. I can't remember if it was them or another organisation. And I kept trying to persuade him that he wasn't the only one thinking this way, that there were people out there who really wouldn't want him to think like this, blah, blah, blah. But the whole time, you're thinking, am I saying the right thing? Now, everyone who's listened to it seems to think I did, but I'm not going to say it was because I had no training to do it. I mean, nobody takes you aside for a training course on how to handle calls like that. You either do it or you don't. And it was quite a moment.
Do you think you're in a very sort of special position as a talk show host, or even people who do podcasts or any sort of audio format, in that everyone feels like they know the person and has a connection with them? Yeah. even if it's not two-way, it's, well, in the caller's mind, it's very much, you are my friend, I'm going to call in.
Well, of course, nowadays you've got ways of knowing that, because you've got Twitter, you've got email, you've got text and all the rest of it, so people can feedback instantaneously what they think of you and how you handled a particular situation, what they think of your views. And I mean, I quite like that. I like instant feedback. I mean, the challenge is to resist responding to it all, because if you respond to every bit of criticism that you get, I mean, it's probably not good for your sanity. I mean, there's a lot of my fellow presenters deny that they ever look at any feedback on the internet. I mean, I don't know if you look at Digital Spy. Well, there's an LBC thread on there, which can get very vicious against some presenters. And I mean, I used to look at that before I ever really presented on LBC. And I do look at it now, because, okay, it may only be, I don't know, 20 or 30 people that ever post on it, but often they've got some interesting things to say. Some of the criticism is gratuitous sometimes, but they are quite nice about me, thank goodness. But I mean, there are one or two presenters that I think, well, I would feel really demoralised actually if I did read a lot of that. And it can get to you if all you get is constant criticism about a particular aspect of your programme or your voice or whatever. I'm sure some people can get very affected by it.
And how do you think of your role as on the radio? Do you think of yourself as a facilitator of bigger communication, or do you want it to be tailored to your own personality just as much?
I don't really look at it like that. I mean, it's a bit of everything. I thought from the beginning, I'm going to do it my way, and if that's not right, then they'll soon get rid of me. And I have done it my way. I'm sure there are mistakes that I've made along the way, but it seems to be working. I mean, my audience figures have rocketed in recent months. I mean, my Sunday show is up 65%, my evening show is up 21%. Now, you're only ever as good as your last radio figure, but from the feedback that you get, not just sort of anecdotally from people who come on the show and sort of they always say they love what you do. Well, okay, I hope they do. Very few people are ever going to come on your show and say they hate what you do. I mean, why would they do that? I don't really see it as, oh, I have a role to do this. You are in a very privileged position. I mean, I get to talk to hundreds of thousands of people every week. In an earlier life, I wanted to be an MP. If I was going to make a speech in Parliament, I'd speak to 30 people if I was lucky. So I may not have any power as a radio presenter, but I certainly can have a bit of influence. And the fact that I know that cabinet ministers listen to the programme, I know that lots of politicians listen to the programme, that does confer a degree of influence. I'm not going to exaggerate it, but it means that I've got an outlet for my views. I mean, my blog used to be the outlet for my views, now it's my radio programme. And because we're not on the BBC, we're entitled to have views and express them. And that is the great thing about a station like LBC, where you actually are paid to be opinionated. Now, not opinionated to the extent that you want to shut out other opinions. I mean, there have been programmes where I've given an opinion at the beginning of the hour and then changed it by the end of the hour because the listeners have actually changed my mind. And it doesn't happen very often, I have to say, but it does happen from time to time. I mean, the work capability test, for example, which I supported. I mean, when you take call after call of people who've been through them and look at the consequences, you then have to reevaluate your opinion.
Hmm. And was being a politician helpful now in terms of being able to interview politicians, seeing their mindset and what they're trying to avoid?
Because you know when they're giving a politician's answer, because it's the kind of answer that you used to give when you were a candidate.
And how are they usually structured? What should we look out for?
Not answering the question.
I think when someone says, well, what really lies underneath your question is, you know they're not going to answer the question, or what I think you meant by that was, I mean, things like that.
So how do you direct the conversation in a way that really gets to what you want to get out of the interview?
You just say, that's a politician's answer, come on, you can do better than that. And there's no point in having a go at them, you've just got to sort of gently encourage them to be slightly more honest. Now, if it's a government minister, and you know that a government minister holds a very different view to the one he or she is actually saying because of collective responsibility, there is no point in trying to do that, because you know that they're not going to say it, because if they did, they'd have to quit their job. So, I mean, there are sort of unspoken rules between an interviewer and a politician, and if you break them, you're not going to get that person back on your programme. So, I mean, that sounds a bit sort of weak, but I mean, for example, John Hayes, or he's the new energy minister, I know he's a climate change sceptic. Well, if he comes on my programme, I'll probably needle him about it a bit and sort of make fun, but he's got to stick to his brief. And if he doesn't, he has to quit.
And how was the transition for you personally between politics and the radio, and how did that transition happen?
It wasn't a transition, really, because I mean, I've been involved in politics in one form or another, I suppose, most of my working life, and I've never actually deliberately said, right, I suppose I deliberately wanted to be an MP, but I didn't deliberately make it my aim to get a radio programme. I wanted to, but I never thought, right, this is what I want to do and this is how I'm going to do it. It was complete coincidence. A friend of mine, Yasmin Alibi Brown, who, I mean, we like each other, but we agree on absolutely nothing. She told me she was having an audition with LBC. And I said, oh, I'd like to do that. So, and I thought she and I could do a programme together, because we sort of bounce off each other quite well. So they said, oh, come and do a joint audition. So we did that, and it was a disaster. And I thought I'd never hear from them again, but they must have seen something. It was a bit embarrassing, because they didn't use her. I hope she's not listening. I think she's forgiven me now. Well, I mean, I didn't actually go and sort of say, well, okay, take me, not her. I would have loved to do a programme with her, and I mean, she's been on my programme since. But it was sort of slightly awkward.
You can't say.
So if you two go and do an audition together, one of you gets it, you'll know how I felt.
Okay, well, hopefully that won't face us in the future anyway, to ease the tension between us now. So okay. Alistair Griffin, Just Drive, this has been recommended. And hopefully, I've never heard this song before, actually.
No, I've never heard it, so
you're
hopefully your music
enlightening us. I'll tell you how, this is a Twitter story. I was watching, I was about to watch football on Sunday afternoon, and Formula One was on. I hate Formula One. And it was just finishing, and this music played. You know when you sort of hear a song for the first time, and it sends a shiver up your spine? Well, this one did. And I tweeted, what on earth was that music? I want to buy it. And somebody then said, oh, it's this by Alistair Griffin. And then Alistair Griffin appeared on Twitter and said, oh, it's me, you can get it here. And since then, he and I have actually become quite good friends, and I've sort of helped him out a little bit in sort of one or two things, and he's just released a new album. And I just think this is the most amazing song.
Okay.
I'm really excited now.
It's Alistair Griffin and Just Drive on Pulse Radio.
Okay. Thank you for joining us again on the Interview Hour. Once again, we're here with Ian Dale, continuing the show. So in terms of, what do you think, let's go on to Cameron, as obviously you're a Conservative. How do you think the Cameron government is performing at the moment?
Well, it's a complete shambles at the moment, isn't it? I mean, it really is. When you think in the last 10 days, the economic figures are sort of unemployment's down, inflation's down, more young people in jobs, blah, blah, blah. And yet, all we have been talking about is some idiot politician that called someone a pleb. and they lost their job over it. Now, that, I mean, I'm not surprised by that, but I think that illustrates the weakness of our political discourse in this country, where we're obsessed by the minutiae of trivia and actually don't concentrate on a lot of the important things. And
do you think that's a failure of communication from the Cabinet government? Or
I think it's partly that. I think there's no strategy in Number 10. They haven't got an Alastair Campbell figure who can sort of knock heads together and create a strategy. They haven't got any real sense of direction, and that needs to change very quickly, because if the electorate starts believing that they are just a shambles, incompetent, no direction, that they're split, then frankly they won't vote for them at the next election. If the Conservatives haven't learned anything over the last 20 years about splits and the fact that the electorate don't like split parties, then they don't deserve to win next time. But I think Cameron himself, in the first 18 months, was a very good Prime Minister. I think he seemed to fit the job like a hand in a glove, but I think somehow he doesn't give that impression anymore. He seems to get riled too easily. Sometimes he's not prime ministerial enough, and I know that sounds really trite and pompous, but I mean, you don't necessarily want the Prime Minister losing his temper every time he's asked a question in the House of Commons. So I think he's got to look very sort of closely at his own actions. He's losing a lot of support among Conservative MPs. I don't think there's any prospect of him being toppled at the moment, but if it goes on much longer, we've seen in the past, Conservatives can be quite ruthless about changing.
I mean, maybe the MPs aren't turning against him so much, but do you think the grassroots are? I mean, I remember Tim Montgomery said the other day that Cameron was one of the most disappointing leaders, Conservative leaders.
Well, it depends what you mean by the grassroots. I mean, if by the grassroots you mean some of the people that read Tim Montgomery's website, then that may be true, but how representative Conservative Home is of the mainstream Conservative Party, I'm never quite sure. I think it's a great website, but I think sometimes it overdoes who it represents. You look at some of the comments on Conservative Home, and I think half of them sometimes are written by UKIP members. But David Cameron should not underestimate the strength of discontent there is among Conservative MPs and indeed other parts of the Conservative Party.
And if you think, what will his legacy be if there is indeed a Cameron legacy, if that's the right way to put it?
Now there's a good question, which I've never ever thought of before. What would people remember? I mean, if Cameron went tomorrow, what would his legacy be? And the fact that I can't give you a straight answer to that question immediately probably indicates what the problem is. I mean, I suppose people, with the main event of his premiership would be the Olympics. Well, okay, everyone played a role in
Boris
delivering
legacy.
Those Olympics. Well, I mean, Boris Johnson, the government certainly played a role in it. The last Labour government played a role in delivering it. Ken Livingstone played a role in delivering it. But in 20 years' time, when we look back on 2012, the only thing that we're going to remember probably is the fact that we had a fantastic Olympic Games. But you see, even there, I thought Cameron played it wrong, in that he seemed to appear at virtually every event there was. And I'm thinking, well, haven't you got any work to do? And I'm thinking, well, if I'm thinking like that, probably a lot of other people in the country are. So, I mean, okay, he's Prime Minister, he can go to any event he likes, but sort of basically to take a month off for the Olympics, I just thought that didn't really give the impression of somebody who was really. And then he had another 2 weeks' holiday afterwards. I think politicians should have holidays. Prime Ministers need to have holidays to recharge their batteries. But I did wonder whether 6 weeks off effectively was maybe a little bit too much.
How do you think they will fare in 2015, the Conservatives?
As of now, Ed Miliband would be Prime Minister. I mean, if the election was now, certainly Labour would win. I mean, the Conservatives are hamstrung because they've got the wretched Liberal Democrats with them, and so that it isn't actually a Conservative government. I think the Liberal Democrats have been a huge influence on this government, not always for the good. And it will be very interesting to see over the next couple of years how the two parties sort of put some distance between them, because going into the next election, they will need to do that. I don't know how the Liberal Democrats are going to fight the next election. I really don't, because, I mean, can they really go into the election saying, we really don't like all these things that have happened over the last 5 years? But, I mean, in some ways, they're going to have to.
How do you think, what do you think the main issue for the Conservatives is at the next election? A lot of the discourse recently has been the growth of UKIP, especially taking people from the right of the Conservative Party.
Well, I mean, the main issue at the next election, I'm sure, will still be the economy. I mean, inevitably, in most elections, it always is. But UKIP are a real threat to the Conservatives. Nobody should underestimate that. I think there's a serious prospect that UKIP could win the 2014 European elections. I don't know many Conservatives who intend to vote Conservative in those elections. They all intend to vote UKIP. Now, if UKIP can somehow hold on to that support at the 2015 election, I don't think they'll win any MPs, but they can certainly stop a lot of Conservative MPs from winning. And all David Cameron has to do is to pass a law before the 2015 election that there will be a referendum. And then UKIP's fox is shot. And I think the fact that... I mean, I was... 12 when the referendum was held in 1975. So, I mean, anyone under the age of 58, is it? I've probably got that wrong, but something like that. Anyone under the age of 58 has not had a say on whether we should be either members of the EU or whether the relationship should be renegotiated. So I see no harm at all in having a referendum, and I don't think anybody on either side of the debate should be afraid of having that debate.
Do you think Cameron will offer the referendum?
No. Well, not an in-out referendum. He might offer one on something else, but not an in-out one.
And where do you think the European Union should go in the future, personally?
Away.
Simple.
I mean, I'm not... The problem with the whole European debate is it's always held on the wrong premise. So you will get pro-Europeans accusing people like me of being anti-European. I did my degree in German. I've lived in Germany for 2 years. I haven't got an anti-European bone in my body, but I have got an anti-EU bone in my body because I do think that it is just grown out of all control. It has far too much influence on our national life. 75% of the laws that we pass in this country emanate from Brussels. And I think with the euro crisis now, that is going to be the catalyst. I can't see how you can have a eurozone and then a non-eurozone all in the same thing. So I think there should be a free trade area, which we should be members of. But I think the eurozone countries inevitably in the end are going to have to come together in a fiscal union. And that was always inevitable from the moment it started. And some of us were saying that back in 1998, because you cannot have a single currency zone with a single interest rate when you have economies as diverse as Greece, Portugal and Germany. I mean, you can't defy the natural laws of economics, and that's what the eurozone has always sought to do. It was always a political entity, and they should have acknowledged that right from the start. And it was always inevitable that Germany and France, in the end, would say, well, we can't bail out everyone to the extent that they need to be bailed out. So something somewhere is going to have to give. And unfortunately, just as we now seem to be coming out of the recession, I think that the eurozone crisis probably will hit again in the next 6 months, and we could be forced back into recession because a large part of our export market has basically gone into recession itself.
Now, you campaigned for David Davis in the leadership elections against David Cameron. If he had won, how do you think a David Davis government would be different to a Cameron government?
Read my essay in a book called Prime Minister Boris and Other Things That Never Happened, because I actually wrote 3,000 words on exactly that. I actually don't think it would have been hugely different. There wouldn't have been the emphasis on the environment, although they're going away from that now. I think in terms of the way the Conservative Party went, in like more women candidates and all of that, I think it would have been very similar. I think we wouldn't have had any of the rubbish about sharing the proceeds of growth that Cameron used to come out with. I think there would have been a much more bigger emphasis on smaller state, lower taxes. But other than that, I'm not sure there would have been a huge amount of difference. I think David Cameron was kind of the right man in the right place in that he was able to at least partially detoxify the Conservative brand in a way that David Davis might have found more difficult. So I don't think that things would have been that much different. Would he have got an overall majority at the last election? Well, we'll never know. And frankly, it's so difficult to say.
And just a general question on politics. What do you think actually makes a successful politician? Have you spotted any magic traits over the years?
I think what makes a successful politician now is very different from what made a successful politician 20, 30, 40 years ago. You cannot be a successful politician now unless you are media friendly. And that's why you've got people at the top of all the political parties who look almost identical. I mean, Miliband, Clegg and Cameron, you could morph them into one quite easily. You've got to have a good head of hair. You've got to be able to look good on television. You've got to be able to tell people a bit about yourself. You can't... I mean, you compare any modern-day politician with Clement Attlee, who is probably the most successful politician of his time immediately post-war. he used to go into interviews and would just give one-word answers. Well, I mean, how could you do that now? And Harold Macmillan would sort of have a nap in the afternoon and sort of read a bit of Trollope. Well, you're not, as a Prime Minister, you don't do that anymore. I think successful politicians have to be great communicators. You look at American presidents. Obama won because of his communication skills. Nobody had a clue what he believed in. Clinton was one of the best political communicators ever, I think, and still is. Ronald Reagan as well would never have got into office had he not been able to communicate well. So that, I think, is one of the... When I decided I wanted to become a politician, I thought, well, that's something I can do. I can do all the TV stuff. I can do all the radio stuff. I can go and sort of sell a policy. What I'm useless at is actually creating the policy in the first place. I mean, political thought, political theory doesn't particularly interest me. It's sort of the practical side that interests me. So, but you've got to have a mix of people. There is no sort of one size fits all. Some people will be good at some things. Others will be good at others.
And was there a part of political culture that you really didn't like at the time? Something that you dreaded every waking up every morning?
The worst thing about politics, I think, is the falseness of it. In that, I mean, as I say, I've been involved in politics ever since I left university. So, God, how long is it now? So long, I can't even think. I left university in 1985, so sort of 30 years old, and I could count on the fingers of one hand the number of friends that I've made, real friends that I've made in politics. Now, that you might say, well, that's a reflection on you rather than them, and you may be right in that. But I do think it's something that where people are used a lot. It's a sort of thing, you go to a political reception and you're talking to someone and you can see them looking over your shoulder to see who's more important than you in the room. And there's a lot of sort of falseness about politics and politicians, and that most people in politics will happily sort of trample over you to get sort of one rung higher on the ladder than you. And I suppose, is something that I never really liked. I'm not sure it's any different to anything else. I mean, if you look in sort of the media, it's a bit like that, where it's a very competitive environment. But I like to like people, and I don't know, in politics, people, you create a lot of needless enemies sometimes, and on my blog, I suppose I did that a lot. And you can't be liked by everybody, but sometimes I think some people delight in being disliked a little bit too much.
I guess it also increases with what you mentioned at the start of things being really based on trivial matters and escalated in the media as well.
You look at the use of social media now in politics, and one word out of place creates a huge firestorm on Twitter. I think it's a great shame. I mean, some politicians won't use social media because they're just afraid of the reaction if they say anything that is slightly off message or sort of too personal or whatever. You look at the trouble Nadine Dorries gets herself into sometimes as a good example of that, where she really does mean well, but sometimes the way she puts things just puts people's backs up too much.
Do you think Twitter has helped the political debate in the UK?
Well, yes and no. I mean, some people, I think, use it very well in politics. I mean, I didn't really get Twitter when it first started, and I remember being on a panel with a guy called Dominic Campbell, who would literally tweet every 2 minutes what he was doing, and I mean every 2 minutes. And I sort of had, it was getting a very, it was a very boring panel, so I decided to liven it up a bit. And I said, you just want to be on Big Brother, don't you? You just want everybody to know about everything that you do. Anyway, about a year later, someone did persuade me to start it. And once I decided what I wanted to use it for, it was fine. And I mean, I love Twitter now, but there are times when I've got myself into trouble using it. I mean, several times, and I've pressed send when there's been that little voice in the back of my head that said no, don't press send, but I've still done it anyway, and then suffered the consequences.
But it must be political instinct to be quite careful what you tweet about anyway, due to the legal implications of it even, and defamatory statements. So isn't there always something at the back of your mind just saying be careful what
there should be
there?
And I mean, you should really, anything sort of remotely controversial, you should always count to 10 before you send it. But if you got anything interesting to say, of course you're going to go off the rails from time to time. And as a politician, that can be absolutely disastrous. Now, whenever I've gone off the rails, I mean, I'm not in politics, but I mean, there's one occasion when, I mean, people threatened to sort of contact LBC and say I should lose my job. And I mean, I'll tell you what it was if you want. I'm still a bit embarrassed about it, but
go for it.
Well, I'd finished my program on a sort of Friday night, and I was getting the train back to Kent from Charing Cross, and for whatever reason, I wasn't in a particularly good mood, and I sat down in my seat on the train, and this woman tried to sit beside me, but I could tell she was drunk, and there were loads of other empty seats, so I had my iPod on, so I just sort of beckoned to her to go to another seat, so she sat at the one diagonally opposite me in the group of four. And she started sort of swaying around, and I thought, oh my God, she's going to be sick. And of course, I started tweeting about it. I was giving like a running commentary on what she was doing. So of course, somebody on Twitter then says, take a picture of her.
Oh gosh.
And like an idiot, I did. Now, the picture didn't show her face. I mean, you could not recognise her from it. But she was sort of like, got her head in her hands. But I compounded that by putting underneath it, this is the disgusting slapper sitting opposite me. Now, I could have chosen my words, shall we say, more carefully. Mm. So there then ensued, I mean, I was trending worldwide on Twitter, basically, sort of how dare this disgusting man sort of do this, post this picture, and how dare he call her a slapper. And I sort of rather lamely then said, yeah, but where I come from in Essex, everyone calls each other a slapper. It doesn't actually mean what you're saying it means, which I admit was a fairly weak defence. And I mean, the world just went mad. And I mean, there were people sort of saying, because I think I'd actually been talking about drunk people on sort of, because I don't like seeing drunk people, whether they're male or female, and people saying, oh, you wouldn't have done that if you'd been a man. Yes, I would actually. But it was quite a, I mean, the tweets were coming in so fast that I couldn't read them because I was sort of going up the screen so fast. I mean, I got about another sort of 2,000 followers out of it, but it was quite an uncomfortable experience.
Do you think you were like a victim of your sort of name and position? Because if any other regular Joe tweeted that, there wouldn't be any.
No, clearly not. But I mean, it wasn't a nice thing to do. It wasn't a chivalrous thing to do. But then again, being drunk in public isn't a nice thing to do either. And I mean, bearing in mind she wasn't exactly 16. She ought to know better.
How do you deal with that massive information constantly coming online, though? It must be quite... It can be quite dangerous to someone's self-esteem, obviously, if they get constant criticism or constant information coming through, which you can't control.
Well, in the end, you have to let a lot of it just be water off a duck's back. Mm. I mean, it wasn't a nice experience, but then again, I've had lots of other experiences where I've used Twitter. I mean, when my mother died, I mean, I had some absolutely wonderful messages. So, I mean, you have to take the rough with the smooth. And if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. I mean, it's like I said before, you can't be liked by everybody. There are some people on Twitter, I could be the second coming and they would still find some fault with me. And I just accept that that's going to happen. And you cannot, there are some people you just cannot convince that you actually do have good motives, that you're not this horrible person that they think you are. And, I mean, so be it.
Yes, the issue is, though, that there's more rough than smooth when it tends to come to social media, because people who are satisfied tend to just listen and not exclaim their adoration.
Well, I'm not sure about that. If it was more rough than smooth, then I wouldn't do it, frankly. I mean, I did get sick of blogging for a time, and so that's why I closed down my blog originally. I kind of now slightly regret that, because I do miss it a little bit, and I'm thinking about sort of starting up again in maybe a slightly different form. I mean, anybody in the public eye, whether you're in television, radio, politics, whatever, you've got to accept that you're going to be a bit of a Marmite character to some people. There's no shades of grey, let alone 50.
Like you mentioned blogging there. One of the questions always asked about blogging is, where's the line between blogging and journalism? And where do you think... do you think blogging has become more respected as a form of journalism?
Yes, I do. When blogging first started, people like me were considered to be rather sad, people who had nothing better to do with their times but sit in their bedrooms in their stripy pyjamas and sort of pontificate to their three readers. And it was quite funny how sort of mainstream journalists would always trot out this line of argument until they realised that we were getting, or one or two of us were getting very large audiences for what we were saying. And then the newspaper editors suddenly cottoned onto it, and they ordered their journalists to do it. So the mainstream media, in the end, ate up independent blogging. And what they did was they signed up some of the better bloggers to write columns. I didn't start blogging because I wanted to be a political journalist. If I'd wanted to be a political journalist, I probably would have been a political journalist. But I viewed it as a means for me having a platform to say what I wanted to say. I wasn't intending to break stories. I mean, I did in the end, but I wanted to use it effectively as an opinion column. And I'd never heard of blogging until I went to Washington in about 2002. And a friend of mine showed me his blog, and I thought, wow, I can see what I could do with that. And very few people in this country were blogging at that time. So I started off and sort of really enjoyed it. And again, it's a bit like the talk show. You have to insert yourself in it. So it wasn't just me saying Ian Duncan Smith should resign or isn't Tony Blair rubbish or whatever. I remember delivering a eulogy at someone's funeral. I'd never done that before, so I wrote about the experience. I'd talk about going to West Ham and go to the cup final and stuff like that. So it was meant to be kind of a personal diary rather than just a means of me giving my political views.
How is it sharing that much of yourself in public, though? Because sometimes when you write something, you feel that you can't fully express yourself in a paragraph, for example, that it doesn't actually reflect the true complexity of what you're thinking.
Well, I never had a policy of saying, well, I have to write this in five lines or something. And that's a disadvantage of Twitter, where you only have 140 characters. How can you conduct a serious political debate in 140 characters? Whereas on the blog, you could, and I would sometimes write 1,000 words if I wanted to, depending on what it was. And I would introduce a lot of humour. I'd do sort of like David Letterman style top 10 lists. I would have a big links things and link to other blogs, because in the end, it was in the initial years sort of political bloggers against mainstream journalism. So we would all link to each other in a way that newspaper journalists never would. They do now, but they didn't then.
With the way digital media is progressing, not just through blogging, but through internet, newspapers, radio, how that's moving to more digital media and through podcasts, etc., do you think traditional media will eventually die out, or do you think there will always be a place for it?
I don't know the answer to that question. It's very interesting. This week we've heard Newsweek is stopping having a printed edition. It's just going online. Now, that's quite a big thing, and it could lead... I mean, it's been rumours for a long time that The Independent or The Guardian might do that. I have no idea. Do you have media studies courses at LSE?
No.
You wouldn't do anything so down market, would you? But a friend of mine was giving a lecture to a media studies course, about 30 students. This was several years ago now. And said to them, which of you buy a daily paper? This was literally 2006. One of them put their hands up. Now, if media studies students aren't buying papers and they're looking at it online, if they were doing that in 2006, well, they're certainly doing it now. So over time, newspaper buyers are going to die out. I don't buy newspapers to anywhere near the degree that I used to. I used to buy three newspapers every day. I still get Sunday newspapers because I can't get out of the habit of Sunday newspapers. But it's very rare now that I buy a weekday newspaper, which for somebody who's in sort of political journalism to a degree is a bit odd, but I would obviously look at it mostly online.
And you mentioned that you might go back to blogging later. What are you thinking of? Are you allowed to give that information?
Well, I created the Dale & Company site, which is effectively a group blog where there's sort of 50 or 60 people contribute to it, and I write when I want to. But it was never meant to replace the previous blog, but I just had this idea and I thought, well, it might work. It hasn't given me anywhere near the satisfaction that my own blog did. And I haven't, to be honest, I haven't decided what to do. I'm sort of on the verge of thinking, well, I might start up another individual blog, but it won't. I don't want to go back to doing exactly the same kind of thing as I did before. It would probably be more based on what I'm doing on the radio than anything, and sort of what I'm doing in the publishing world.
Do you find the subject that you're interested in changing over time? For example, you mentioned that you covered some difficult topics on radio.
Yeah.
Do you feel that maybe if you went back to blogging, that aspect would also come through?
I mean, I'm not going to say I'm not going to write about politics, because clearly I'm still really interested in politics, but I think over the last couple of years I've got interested in an awful lot of other things that I think I could write about sort of quite well. So anyway, I haven't decided what to do.
Well, in the future.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but
you didn't get to play my other songs.
Oh, we'll finish with it. It's fine.
We've got a song by Alphaville. It's not the one you wanted, unfortunately, but it's big in Japan, so the first one you wanted.
Thank you very much for coming on to our show once again. And it was a pleasure to speak to you. So let's end on some music.